Hello, and welcome to The Spark. I'm Matt, and by the grace of the Nashville Public Library, I'm here to talk about the creative process and the joy of appreciating the creations of others. Thankfully, I'm not going to do it alone. Joining me today is a library staff member who runs tabletop role-playing game programs for the teen department, as well as running NPL's upcoming actual play podcast, Overdue Adventures. It's Andrew Palmer.
Hello.
Hello, welcome.
Thank you.
So you said you had some programming this week. Was that D&D programming?
I run gaming programs once a week, and so this week was just general board games. Ooh. But as of this recording, next week is spring break, so I'll be doing my spring break Dungeons & Dragons club with my teens, and for 2 days straight, we'll have kind of these two-hour intensive sessions where we come to the end of a big arc that we've been working on.
Nice. What board game did you play yesterday?
Yesterday, they veered more towards card games like Uno and Phase 10. And those are really easy for just setting up and then having the teens just gravitate to them because they play them all the time. It's a game that most of them already know how to play. But the week before, I featured a game called The Illiterati, and it's about this secret organization that is against literacy. And so you have these Scrabble tiles, and you have to make words under a certain time, and you have these prompts. And so it's kind of like Bananagrams, Scrabble, and but like with prompts. Yeah. And so it's really fun because it's a collaborative game as well. You and the other players are playing against this secret organization. So I love anything that can kind of blend the nerdy aspect of learning or reading or creative writing with gameplay.
Yeah, yeah.
That's kind of my thing, I guess.
So backing up slightly, we're going to be talking a lot about role-playing games for the next 45 minutes to an hour.
Perfect.
For anyone who may be listening who is not as familiar with that realm,
right?
How do you go about explaining it to bring people in, whether for programming or for your own games?
Yeah, I tend to use the phrase collaborative storytelling, and the way I pitch it to like library supervisors or anyone that is approving funding, it's kind of like taking the vibe of book clubs for adult programming and story time for children and smashing it together for teens and creating this storytelling space that is immersive and interactive and has this fun gameplay chance with the dice. So we always say at the table, the dice have a story to tell, and so do these teens. They have some wild takes that they like to make known at the table, and so I end up having just as much fun as they're having at the table, which is nice.
Good. So what is your personal history with RPGs? When did you start playing? What games have you played?
Sure. So I got started just as I was graduating college in 2012, 2013. And the first game that I played was Pathfinder First Edition because a 3.5 veteran didn't want to play D&D 4th Edition. And he was like, oh, here's this weird Pathfinder thing. We're going to try that out. And it actually ended up being very formative for how I run games, because Pathfinder, as opposed to Dungeons & Dragons, which are both very similar role-playing systems, like Pathfinder is based on the third edition of Dungeons & Dragons, but their modules or stories that they write for you to run with your players are a lot more streamlined, I'll say, in that it's less sandboxy, which basically means you as the storyteller set up the world, give a plethora of options, and just see where your characters go. But Pathfinder had this idea of there's a story to tell, there's chapters to it. Every campaign was split into six chapters that had their own arcs. So the first chapter might take you from levels 1 to 4 and then 5 to 7, so on and so forth until you're the highest level, which is level 20 in D&D. So I did that for 8 years or so. And then when me and my friends wanted to start a D&D podcast, we were like, no one knows what Pathfinder is. So D&D has that reputation. It has that name recognition that we were looking for. So, and we were like, well, they're now on 5th edition, the D&D 4th edition that nobody liked. Nobody's playing it anymore. So we felt like it was safe to come back to that game. And because Pathfinder was like more complex, we actually found it pretty easy to slip into the D&D rules because they were more accessible. More simplified. So as opposed to like 24 skills that your character might have, there's only 10 to 12. And that worked really well for taking D&D and making it a performative storytelling experience, something that we're both playing at our table, where I'm the storyteller and my four friends are playing as these characters experiencing that story. And those simplified rules made it easier to tell the story. And then that was a lot of fun, successful. And then I started working with teens at the library. I had been in adult services before, doing more like book clubs and those kinds of things. And a lot of my teens, just through conversation, found out that I was playing D&D at home and had this podcast and all that kind of stuff. And they were just naturally curious because they had been hearing things about it through like Stranger Things and other forms of pop culture and media. And so this was around 2018 that the students were like, well, can we do D&D for some of our programs? Like, we're not as into the crafts and those kinds of things that were normally being put out. And so I was like, all right, well, let's start a registration list. For most of them, it's their first time playing. And this is the first opportunity that they're getting to see what the game's like. So you want to make sure it's a as good as it's going to get kind of experience. So that can set them up to take what they learned from playing at the library to taking it home and running their own games or being a player at their home games and stuff. So yeah, now it's been like 7-ish years that I've been running D&D programs for teens. Nice. So I've seen some of them go from little middle schoolers to seniors who all play with their friends now, and multiples of them are, or a few of them are like DMs and do their own thing now, and it's really cool to see.
D&D is in some ways like a weirdly wholesome pyramid scheme insofar that you have to get other people into it to keep doing it.
Yeah, I think that's part of the beauty of it and some of the entrapment of like, when it's good, it's really good. When it's bad, it can be really bad. Like, you can lose friends over bad D&D games. So it's a level of commitment. Like, anyone who is listening that has a weekly board game night, imagine that. But now you're not only dealing with your friends' attitudes or emotions, you're also dealing with their angsty characters' emotions and being put into these high pressure situations sometimes. And there's a lot of room for conflict. And, you know, that can even happen at the table during a library program. And some of it's fun and can just add to the drama. Sometimes it's like, oh, I have to address this as the program lead or literally the adult in the room. So, right.
Now, and that is the cool thing about role-playing games in general is that, like, you're removing just enough of the artifice of you as a person to, like, let parts of you come out that you didn't necessarily know were there or were going to come out in this way. And that can be remarkably healthy in a space of, like, trust and safety with people that you care about. But to your point, it can also not.
Yeah, the hope.
And that's why we have various emotional rules in place at Good Tables.
Yes, the session zero is a now more well-known tool that a lot of storytellers, dungeon masters, game masters, whatever the title, will use to make sure that the expectations of the players are known, as well as the expectation of the leader, the storyteller, or the dungeon master. That way, with those known rules out in the open, you all can have a better chance at not running into those drama or like snags of like hiccups in your storytelling or touching on something that somebody has already said was a boundary or something like that. There's never going to be a perfect way to make sure that your game doesn't touch on negative emotions or have some kind of what we call like out of game bad experience as opposed to an in-game experience. Yeah, but having session zeros, setting those expectations will at least give you a chance to avoid those moments.
Mm-hmm. And also like set the tone of like, what kind of story are we looking to tell before we start telling it and you know, understanding each other's characters, if that's relevant. All very important stuff.
Yeah, and anyone listening who hasn't played D&D before, there's lots of subgenres within even a high fantasy game. Like, you could have a bunch of pirate-type characters show up, and suddenly it's this, like, Viking wilderness game, and it's like, all I brought was this cool vest and like a swashbuckling sword, and now I am like facing the tundra cold. Like, if you don't have that narrative expectation, you can run into those moments. So like letting your players know, hey, we're doing a fifth level pirate campaign, like bring some dexterous characters that can leap from tall heights or talk their way out of a situation, and that can help guide your players to make characters that will shine within the story that you have set up for them.
And to the point of subgenres, like we talked in the episode that went out last month with Haley and Beck about the moldability of D&D as a system. In terms of that, I always think of my introduction to D&D was the Adventure Zone podcast.
Oh, nice.
And the fact that their first, like, multi-year campaign was essentially just a greatest hits of various fictional genres or tropes, because, you know, one campaign would be an Agatha Christie train mystery. Mm-hmm. One would be the DM was into Fast and Furious that month, an extended time loop arc.
What's fun about that show is that they're bringing the same characters sometimes into those new genres, and that can just set you up for some good comedy gold.
Oh, yeah. So going from playing a long-form Pathfinder game directly into, hey, we want to have a D&D podcast, I assume other actual play podcasts were an inspiration for you wanting to do that.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. One that I loved because, I don't know, I was starting to get into like Critical Role, the big ones, and Dames and Dragons was one that I found on a Reddit somewhere, and it was four friends from college who were like, hey, we want to record our first time playing D&D, let's do this. And it turned into this, you know, kind of larger thing. And that was the podcast that I listened to where I was like, oh, I could do that. Like, I get together with my friends from college, and basically their whole thing was creating a wholly unique world and storyline, and having that homebrew, like building your own world, basically writing a epic fantasy series for your friends to play through. I was like, at the time, there were so few D&D podcasts out that I thought that's what you had to do if you weren't a D&D affiliate or something like that. And so when we went to do our podcast, I was like, well, I have to make a whole world for it. I have to make my own storyline for it. I have to make my own NPCs. I can't use anything licensed. And then later found out about the open license. But being tricked into doing all that hard work meant that there was so much more of me in that story and so much more fun that me and my friends could not only tell a story all together at the table with dice, but we could also build this new world together for us to hang out in a few hours a week.
Yeah. Is that podcast that you started then still going?
Yeah, we're in our fourth season, and I think it's been going for 6 or so years. Nice. So we have 2 more seasons left, and that campaign from third level to we're hoping to maybe get to level 20 by the end of it with the same characters.
Wow.
But we'll see. So yeah, if you're planning on doing a long form narrative like campaign, be ready, especially if you're an adult and have limited time that you can get together with people. Be ready for if you want to go from like a low level to level 20, that might take a couple of years. But yeah, a lot of our downtime between seasons has been, you know, learning how to edit, produce, do sound effects, you know, get music, background music, and all that kind of fun stuff. But that learning curve helped also form how we then play at the table after each next season comes out. Like the things we learned from the previous season, we can bring to the table and take the mistakes that were made and, you know, try to do things a little bit better each next time.
Yeah. And before we get too far away from it, what is this podcast called?
Oh, it's called Chasm Quest. It's all one word, Chasmquest. And it's on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, etc. Not geared towards teens, more of for an adult audience. So I'll say that.
So are you in the various games you play outside of programming? Are you sort of an eternal DM? Do you get to play sometimes?
Yes. There's even a board game group that I get together with, and we're playing a campaign-like board game. And even with that, I'm still kind of the DM, the one like looking up the rules, deciding the rules or reminding. But at least the storytelling and the mechanics are built into the engine of the board game. So I get to do a little bit less there. But yeah, usually if I'm getting together with friends, I'm the assumed forever DM, which is why video games like Baldur's Gate 3 are such a beautiful thing for forever DMs, because it gives you the chance to be a player for hundreds of hours.
And to control the entire party at that.
Yes.
Yeah. So the long form board game, I assume that's a legacy game of some kind.
It's the smaller module of Gloomhaven.
Okay.
Jaws of the Lion.
Yeah.
It's a lot of fun. We're at level 6 now, so we're kind of in those last couple chapters.
Nice. Yeah, it's on my shelf. I have not tried it yet.
As most of my board games are, on the shelf, ready to get broken open and learned and taught by myself. And forcing my friends to... That was kind of what the podcast was about, too, was like, oh, if we're doing D&D for something, like for an audience, like that will create a better incentive for people to get together and actually carve out time in their schedules, less likely to cancel last minute coming for the. So it was a little bit of using honey to, you know, draw my friends in and then get them stuck.
Yeah, that's a good idea.
At my table.
Had you played any of the previous ones, or did you jump in with Baldur's Gate 3?
It's funny, my CRPG or computer role-playing game experience really mirrors my tabletop role-playing experience, because I started with the Owlcat Pathfinder computer role-playing games. Owlcat is the production company, but it's commissioned by the Pathfinder company, Paizo, and it's the first edition, and they took two of their most famous or infamous campaign stories and turned them into video games. And so that was my first taste of, oh, this is fun, like character creation and all that kind of stuff. And those ones are based more on like the 90s, early 2000s type of isometric, you know, top-down kind of experience. But Baldur's Gate 3 was the first Wizards of the Coast or D&D commissioned CRPG that I've played. I haven't gone back and played Baldur's Gate 1 and 2. I might at some point, but I've played a few other old school style ones like Pillars of Eternity 1 and 2. Those are really fun. And I think I have Tyranny, also by Obsidian, who did Pillars of Eternity. That's like my next to play because I just needed something to give me a break from Baldur's Gate, because I'm on my like fourth playthrough, maybe fifth. I've lost track, actually.
Yeah, I have queued up Divinity Original Sin 2.
Which nice. Is,
yeah, Larian's previous game before Baldur's Gate 3. I'm very curious to see how a studio that's so thoroughly and lovingly translated an extant role-playing game system made their own system and
absolutely
world. Yeah. And also how it's small enough to run on my Switch.
Yeah, I didn't even think about that. Those games are such powerhouses, and anyone who's dipped their toes into computer role-playing games knows, like, you're about to commit a minimum of 80 hours to, if you want to complete this game, if you get the chance to. And so to see that kind of AAA cinematic quality go into Baldur's Gate 3 was like so fun, so cool. Because my other favorite video games are very narrative based, like Red Dead Redemption 2 or Last of Us series, those types of games that are very character and narrative focus, to the point where like sometimes you feel you're just along for the ride. And Baldur's Gate had that just perfect sweet spot of, you can be just along for the ride, or you can go and explore like every nook and cranny. So I definitely have to put Divinity Original. Is it Divinity Original Sin?
Divinity Original Sin 2.
2.
I know is the name of the second game in the series.
DOS 2.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Whether it's the most video game sounding title I've ever heard.
It really is.
So not having been a player very much in D&D, and now having done a significant amount of Baldur's Gate and getting to like sample so many different classes, have you found yourself like gravitating towards certain classes in those playthroughs?
Yeah, I tend to gravitate toward classes that can do a little bit of everything. So classes that can be the tank up front, but can also do some control spells, some damage spells. So my first playthrough was a paladin. Paladin's one of those classes where for so long I hadn't played any games with a paladin, had never played a paladin before. And then once I played a paladin, I understood why that's the main for so many people, because just the power to, because like when you choose a fighter or a barbarian, it's because Hulk wants to smash, right? It's like you want to be destroying things. And the Paladin, I feel like, just allows you to do that even more. It's ramped to 11. You have healing abilities. You have armor available to you. Mm. It's the best of all worlds. If I were ever to do like a solo mode game, I would choose like a Paladin type character that can spell cast and do martial. And then my second playthrough, I think I did an Eldritch Knight Fighter, which is pretty much the same thing, but instead of divine spells, you're more doing those wizard evocation type spells. Yeah. I think the current run, I'm trying to do honor mode. So I looked up a bunch of stuff about it, and I'm playing a monk Way of the Open Hand and abusing the Tavern Brawler feat, which if anyone's listening still
and doesn't know,
that sentence sounded wild, I'm sure. But anyone who does know knows exactly what I'm talking about. Mm-hmm. But yeah, it just lets you do an insane amount of damage on one turn. And pretty soon I'm going to multi-class into Rogue Thief just to get an extra bonus action so I can just do flurry of blows, two attacks, and just demolish people in one turn.
Yeah, everyone else is like, and the monk is still going?
Yep.
Monk is still going.
The monk is the martial equivalent of a wizard, I feel like. The wizard's just taking all their time choosing which spell to cast because that action economy, you're like, it's got to be the exact right spell because I've got six people to go through before it's my turn again and the whole battlefield will have changed. That's how it is for the monk, but that whole time they're just punching things.
Yeah. I just remember very shortly after Baldur's Gate 3 came out, there was a video of Matt Mercer playing it, and he had been storing up like just wooden crates in his inventory, like presumably in his chest at camp, and then he would just like bring a couple out at a time. But there was a like very tall building that he wanted to get into that he was not supposed to get into.
Nice.
So he just precariously stacked dozens of wooden crates.
Yes. Yes. And he got into the building. So I feel like that game was made by Forever DMs for Forever DMs because it's like Matt Mercer's the kind of Forever DM that is going to find the ways to break the game in fun ways like that. Yeah. It's just perfect for people who have sat at the table running the game and creating that experience for others. It's that perfect opportunity to finally be the player and be like, oh, somebody crafted this whole world, this whole game, this whole storyline for me to have this dope experience. And yeah, that's probably my only negative feedback about Dungeons & Dragons is that I wish I could be a player more.
Right. And I imagine you're not alone because of so many other smaller RPG systems that are meant to be like DM-less or at least sort of collaboratively DM'd among the players.
Take some of the pressure off. Mm-hmm. Whereas D&D, like with its starter sets and all that kind of stuff, the support that they have for educators where they've sent me materials to use, like it is designed to sit down, have a index card sized character sheet with just the numbers that you need. And you don't even have to know what they mean yet. But you can just sit down, and as long as you have a DM or a program leader who is willing to give you space to look up some things, help you check things on your character sheet, or I'll just say, hey, these are the names of the spells. If what you can infer about those spells makes you want to cast that one, then we'll look up all the details about it and maybe we get it wrong, but it doesn't matter because it was just what that character wanted to do at the time or what that player wanted to do. And just making those moments happen as seamlessly or efficiently as possible to make those first time playing fun and not something where there in the car ride back with their parent and thinking like, I think I had fun, but I spent I spent like 20 minutes counting dice and adding numbers, like
determining what a 6-foot radius was.
Right, exactly. Like I wanted to do cool stuff, but the DM said I was 10 feet too far away and was out of movement. I don't know. So, you know, you fudge some of those numbers to make a fun experience, because at the end of the day, it's a game. And if the rules are getting in the way of that, you know, they give you permission to skew some of those rules, bend them in a way that makes that experience better. Mm.
So talking to Haley and Beck last time, they talked about how sort of regardless of the group, when they're working with the sort of 6 to 10-year-old demographic, very, very frequently it becomes, as they put it, an animal rescue simulator. Do you find working with the teen groups that across groups, across years, are there similar like kinds of stories that they are wanting to tell when they enter that space?
Yeah. If you ever have just a little guy as an NPC or a bad guy, they will want to quickly adopt that little guy and maybe even write up fantasy adoption papers using like a forgery skill kit. And yeah, and you will have to play their little kobold baby now. That
always
happens
all
a lot.
The time.
Kobolds and goblins, they're just fun to throw in there as like just fodder for the battle, but they're also fun to be these just little chaos agents or just cute little guys that the characters grow fond of and then you use later to betray them.
Yep.
Or kill off to create some sort of emotional reaction.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, you can speedrun all of the easiest, like, emotional manipulations that we've developed over thousands of years of fiction. Just in 2 sessions.
In 2 sessions, because Carlos the goblin got his head cut off, yeah, in front of everyone. It's not always that violent or that devious, but the kids thrive on the chaos. And there are times where I really have to, like, rein it in and be like, these 3 students, they're having fun. These other 2 haven't been able to say a word. And so that kind of like table management, if you're in any kind of public service or wanting to volunteer with the library and run these kinds of programs, you have to have this built-in confidence of like, I'm still, like I said earlier, the adult in the room. I'm still the leader of this table. And while I do want to have fun and let the kids have fun, there's still a set expectation, and built into the library is our code of conduct where like, it basically is like, don't be mean to each other, respect each other, all those basic things, to make the space a welcoming space. But at the same time, like D&D, you know, how much does a kid want to push the limits of like, well, my character's a bully, so I'm bullying this other kid because I'm not bullying them, I'm bullying their character. And it's like, those are the kinds of things where you have to kind of either try to stomp out early or be able to deal with in a way, or just recognize, oh, they came in together, they're best friends, this is just how they play. And maybe I mentioned that at the table, like, oh, good thing you guys know each other so well, so that that didn't actually hurt their feelings.
Yeah, set the expectation.
Right. And always before starting a game, I'll kind of have everyone go around the table and introduce themselves out of game and in game, just so that they can, you know, say what they're excited for. Sometimes we'll play a game where, like, I'll have them say 1 word each and the words get scrambled up and become their team name or something. Because you just got to find unique creative ways to create community, but like on a fast track, because you only have, you know, an hour and a half or 2 hours or sometimes only an hour to create what me and my friends have been building at our table now for over a decade, which is wild to think of God, I'm old.
So in programming settings, are you typically using extant source books? Or if so, do you like pull the room of like, hey, what source book do I want to use?
Some of them have said like, oh, I've always wanted to play XYZ. I've always wanted to play through Curse of Strahd, or I've always wanted to play the elements or the elemental evil. You know, they kind of tell me what flavor they want, and I might mix some stuff up. I might find something that I've wanted to test out, because at the table there, I tell the students, like, if you're playing Randy the Dwarf one week, you can come back as Josephine the High Elf the next week, because this is like a play test type of experience here at the library, because we meet regularly. We're building off of, you know, years of playing together, but we're so frequently playing with new players that everything's still really malleable. And there's some lore that I let them carry over, like, oh, my level one character has this dark crystal that has all these powers from a previous campaign, but I don't let them get all like overpowered overlord. You know, it's just this fun connection that student has with their new character to an older campaign or an older storyline. And yeah, I just say, like, play what you think is going to be fun here. And if it's not fun, change it up for the next time we get together. And that kind of takes the pressure off that they have to play it right or play it perfect. And, oh, maybe I'm not having fun, but maybe that's a sacrifice I need to make in order to play this game. And I try to let them know, like, no, like, you having fun is important. Same with me. So I find new, fun, creative ways to like take source material, put it in a blender, and let it spew out some smoothie version of it that is going to be a lot easier to digest than a 4-hour long dungeon crawl just to get 400 XP and not even level up, right? So it's like, it's way, like, whatever streamlined experience I learned from Pathfinder or from doing my podcast, crank that up like times 1,000. And that's what I do for the teens, because they are such chaos agents that I just got to kind of match that energy sometimes. But that means that I'm having a lot of fun, and that spur of the moment, the kids keeping me on my toes, helps me be a better improviser, both in drama and comedy, like when I play with my friends or back on my podcast. And so it's all this big feedback loop that, or like iron sharpening iron kind of thing. Like, things that I learn and do for my podcast or at my at-home game are informing what I do at the table for the teens at the library, and vice versa.
Yeah. On the topic of improvisation, it came up with Haley and Beck last time that for them, a huge draw of role-playing games is that they both have, like, theater background, and improv is such a, like, crucible for theater folk.
Yeah.
Is improv something you had experience in before role-playing games, or did it come from role-playing games?
I have had different moments where I have been really into, like, watching and observing improv, or like listening to improv podcasts or watching shows like Dropout Network and especially through Dimension 20 and stuff like that. And then, you know, Comedy Bang Bang and like a few other shows where it's like being as goofy as possible is the shtick. And I was like, that's kind of what I do with my friends. Like, we're just a bunch of weirdos, and it's always really fun when you have friends that, you know, have like this particular type of humor. And when you can get them to laugh, it gives you this just great satisfaction. And so to take that vibe and hash it out at the table is always fun. Like, being able to throw out a one-liner as, you know, Carlos the Goblin in front of the teens and get them to laugh, like, catch them off guard, that's the moment where I'm like, all right, I did it. I won.
I got my good braid chemicals for the week.
Exactly. So never did like improv or theater seriously myself, but I always kind of dabbled in it. I did a lot of like live performance stuff, like through bands in high school and college. Was in like a theater class in high school, but it wasn't, I don't have the best memory, so it just didn't work for me.
Sure.
Because memorizing lines was always just like an anxiety-inducing experience.
Sure.
And so D&D is this perfect blend for me, honestly, where like I don't have to memorize lines, or, you know, I can have the highest peak of drama, but I can also have the most gutter comedy mm-hmm. within minutes of each other in a game. And we can still be out of game and make those jokes, and performing for an audience through like a podcast, it's okay to do that. Whereas if you're performing on stage mm-hmm. for people that paid tickets to see this particular play, and suddenly you're making like, you know, pop culture references during Les Mis, like you're going to get booed off the stage. Mm-hmm. Like you're fired. So yeah, I love D&D and that freedom to be like goofy, imaginative, immersive, but at the same time, you can tell a compelling story that suddenly flips and you're like, oh crap, this is like a real moment for this character. Mm-hmm. And things got real quiet at the table. Yeah. So I love both of those. I actually have more of a creative writing background, like mm-hmm. short stories and novels and stuff, that I was always just too scared to like publish.
Yeah.
And so that was also part of the incentive of doing Chasm Quest was, oh, I can write a high fantasy trilogy, but just release it as two seasons of a podcast mm-hmm. For each book that I would have written. And that's been so much fun, because then my best friends get to role play as the main characters in that story, and I can write fun things for them to experience, but also for the audience to hear and immerse themselves into.
And they get to some degree, depending on your play style and the story, shape that plot.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would say that my play style for the show has very much ebbed with what we call railroading and sandbox. Like, first season was very railroaded, like you're on one ship, you're on this expedition, it's moving, and you're kind of just having these monster of the week experiences with each new settlement you go to. But then as we got into seasons 3 and 4, I wanted them to have more agency. Mm-hmm. And so the next arc gave them the ability to have a headquarters and build their own settlement and restore a castle and start commerce and open a pub that the bard does their theater shows out of, you know, so fun stuff like that, that lets them take a break and have some downtime as these epic characters who just want to kick back, have a couple of drinks, and have these smaller moments with their NPCs. And it's a lot of fun to try to weave those different play styles, like making sure the characters have agency so they feel like they're shaping the story and the world, but then also moving things along so it doesn't feel like the listeners are getting 4 or 5 episodes of one at the table conversation and character. You know, like you got to move the plot along a little bit, and some of that comes with like post-production stuff, but sure. It also comes with how I'm presenting things and how we run things at the table as well.
Yeah. And is the keeping things moving the main difference that you find when running a game for just folks at a table, folks in a teen program, versus knowing that there will be an audience on the other side?
Oh, yeah. And it's wild, because I feel like it's on a spectrum of, not saying my talent's at this level of spectrum, but on a spectrum of Dimension 20, a Brennan Lee Mulligan experience versus a Matt Mercer Critical Role experience. Mm. Like the Dimension 20 show, if you're listening and have seen it, you know that it's a very manicured post-production camera work. It's a produced show to be enjoyed within 1 or 2 hours, whereas Critical Role is just friends sitting at a table for 4.5 hours per session and goofing and, you know, having those dramatic highs and those comedy lows. But it's like way more content, not a streamlined experience. And so I was like always trying to gauge like what I can learn from both of those mediums, because it's that type of thing when you're in any niche fandom or niche creative space, there's always these like subgenres upon subgenres and all these different ways to nerd out about how to run your table, like what kind of homebrew rules are you using, what system are you using, et cetera, et cetera. And so I feel like what all of my experience doing the podcast has done is it helped me culminate to a point where I could be asked by our production services and be like, hey, we want to do a D&D show for the library. Can you do it in 6 or 7 recordings? Mm. Can you tell a story from beginning to end that will be fun, enjoyable, and we'll have an audience on the other end? It's almost impossible not to be thinking about the audience on the other end, because unlike my own personal home games or my podcast, the Nashvillian people, citizens, are paying for this production to take place. And so I had to be that much more aware of how time was being spent at the table and how this can engage patrons and listeners and viewers, and how it will then also help promote what we do at the library. Because I think what we do at the library, whether it's with children's, teens, or adults, no matter the age, the tabletop programming that we do has and continues to build community and build friendships, which is the type of service that the library at its heart, I think, is about. Mm-hmm. It's about connecting people through stories, through community, through activities, and not asking so much of the recipient. You know, this is a place where you can freely receive these types of gifts, this community, etc. And so I wanted that to be reflected in the game that we played. Mm. And I wanted that respect of the viewers or listeners' time to be portrayed as well. So yeah. I wanted the group of us, when we finally got together for Overdue Adventures and picked a storyline and started recording, I really wanted it to feel like they were experiencing an episodic narrative, but they were also watching 5 or 6 friends at a table just enjoying hanging out as well. And that can be a hard line to toe, but when done well and when the expectations are on the table, no pun intended, it can be a really great time, not only for us to experience, but for people to consume as a media.
Yeah. And that the Overdue Adventures is also like fully library staff as well.
Absolutely. From all corners, we have children's staff, admin staff, managerial staff, teen staff. And so you get a mixed bunch of different library staff, folks you might even know from your neighborhood library, who you get to see taking on these characters and these fun adventures. And it's a very spooky pirate story as we follow the Ghosts of Saltmarsh campaign.
Okay, cool.
Yeah, we play 2.5-ish modules out of that book, but I homebrew it so it feels like a complete beginning to end kind of story. So really excited for folks to see that.
Yeah, everyone be on the lookout for that on the various Nashville Public Library podcast feeds.
Absolutely. And you can already catch our Valentine's Day special on the Nashville Public Library YouTube channel.
So talking about how you as a forever DM sort of threw yourself in the deep end a little bit with Chasm Quest and creating a world and everything, it feels like a mildly natural extension that you would eventually decide, I just want to make my own RPG system.
Yes. And especially with, as I mentioned earlier, the open license, there was some drama with that a few years ago, whether or not they were going to restrict that or open it up. And there was a really scary time for a lot of third-party creators, non-affiliates with Wizards of the Coast, the company, who make content using that open license in order to create their own media, their own homebrew, and have supporters through like Patreon, etc., or sell their own materials. And a part of that was, are we going to be able to play D&D in the future on our show? And so that kind of kickstarted just in the general fandom a lot of other systems to be released, like Critical Role and Matthew Mercer kind of heading up Daggerheart, their own independent system through their publishing company, and a few others were announced that year. And it really just had me thinking, like, what are the mechanics that I find the most important? What are the play aspects that I find the most fun? And how can I develop that for new content creators like podcasters or YouTubers? Because D&D is not perfect, nor is Pathfinder perfect for a recorded medium type of setting. And so my work has been developing a system that'll be really good for people who want to share their story. So it'll be a little bit more streamlined. Instead of I move 10 feet toward X destination, it'll be I use one action to close the distance or to back off. And, and in our minds through the theater of the mind or whatever term you want to use, we're just able to imagine I have backed up approximately 30 to 40 feet without having to get out the ruler and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. So taking small rules like that, adding in things that will help amplify the story. So adding like a stamina bar, or instead of spell slots, having, you know, magic or mana points. So kind of taking from video games like Skyrim and stuff like that, where it has that more fast-paced playability in mind, and adding that to the game to be like, well, during the battle, I can use two or three of my actions on a turn to rest and regain some of that stamina or some of those magic powers through my mana to be able to cast spells again. So yeah, I lost my turn, but now I'm more powerful going into the next turn, as opposed to being like, well, I gotta wait till we're back at camp and take a short rest or take a long rest. It can tell a more full story in one battle, as opposed to relying on this bigger day-by-day kind of system, like really relying on short rests or long rests and stuff. So those are just a few of the mechanics. I could probably talk way too long about the other things I've implemented, but those are the smaller rules that after using a system like D&D 5th edition for storytelling purposes for so long that you just kind of naturally understand what's useful and what's not useful. And, you know, maybe it'll be something that just my team uses for our entertainment purposes. Maybe it'll be something that sticks with people at the table, but that's that kind of creative freedom that tabletop RPGs mixes all together, like story, game design, level design, character creation, all the things you love from like really great video games that started with these tabletop games decades ago.
Right. And is this something you've been able to playtest very much to this point?
Yes, we got it to a point where I realized there were some like deeper mechanic shifts that needed to happen. Mm. So now we're on a bit of a break, but we had three or four sessions where I play tested it with a few close friends and a few just acquaintances who could be like a little that I've never played with before that could be a little more brutally honest about how things played. And I was able to learn so much from just two or three sessions of playing an entire system that I had made on my own and saw what really worked and what didn't work. So all that's still in development. It'll continue to be a passion project for a while, but if there's ever more development on it, maybe you'll hear about it.
Yeah, looking forward to it. Well, thanks so much for joining me.
Of course. Thank you for having me. I love talking RPGs, as you can tell, as I probably took up most of the airspace this episode.
Hey,
but
that's why you're here.
Yeah, it was a lot of fun to chat and would love to do it again sometime.
Yes, sir. Before we get out of here, gut reaction, favorite Baldur's Gate 3 companion?
Lazelle. Easily Lazelle. Mainly because she's so many people's least favorite.
Sure.
And she's the meanest.
She's so good.
But she has the best storyline. You got to give her some time. You just got to give her some time. That's all I can say. No spoilers.
Well, thank you all so much for listening and joining us today. As ever, this podcast is brought to you because of the Nashville Public Library. So if you're listening out there, go get a library card. Whether you're in Nashville or beyond, find your public library, get a card, and use it. Because the best way to support your public library is to let it support you with all of its various services and goods. I bet there's more than you think. Thank you very much.